All right, New York talk number two. Now, we always talking about giving fluids, so let's talk just a little bit about taking it off. So I think the prototypical patient for this is your CHF patient. And I've had a lot of questions regarding Lasix, dosage, frequency, type of administration. Wondering if you can shed a little light on that and what you do for your volume overloaded patient.
Yeah, I don't have a great science base to it, to be honest. I think one of the articles that I often refer people to is the DOSE trial, D-O-S-E, in New England. And I think it came out maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and I believe the lead author was Felker, F-E-L-K-E-R, and it was essentially like looking at Lasix infusion versus spot dosing Lasix, and they had a protocol for high versus low dose spot dosing of Lasix, and I'm going to butcher the protocol, but I think the high dose was equivalent to giving the patient their home dose by mouth Lasix, but just giving it IV, but don't quote me on that. Look up the article. And that's kind of my approach to patients with Lasix dosing. I more or less follow the algorithm of that trial. And I try not to pay attention to the absolute BUN creatinine.
Okay.
As I sort of mentioned in the last talk, if the BUN creatinine is very elevated, my approach to that physiologically is just the kidneys are congested, the CVP is likely high. If they've got a bad EF, presumably if it's systolic dysfunction, heart failure, then giving them Lasix, lowering their preload, is not really going to drop their renal perfusion at all. So
right.
If anything, it should only help renal hemodynamics than harm. Do you have an approach?
Well, I think mine is probably partly dogmatic in a sense that at some point or other that I can't even remember. Some could have been a resident, could have been a staff. When I was a resident, who told me, well, you've got to dose your Lasix depending on the creatinine. So I tend to have an escalating thing, which is highly imprecise and subjective. And if the creatinine's in the 200s and 200s and 300s, I'll probably go with like sort of 80 to 120 of Lasix, fairly high dose,
okay,
spot doses, and then see what happens with it.
Okay.
The people who come in the who are, let's say, on homes of 40, I usually will give a fair bit higher until I see something come out. But again, am I running just into, at this point, risk of autotoxicity and all that? Or is that the way to do it? I have no idea, no data on this whatsoever. It seems to have, empirically and practically speaking, worked, but I really don't know.
One of the things that I try and do with these patients as well, and again, this is totally, this is not evidence-based medicine, is I try and get urine indices on them.
Okay.
When they first come in, ideally, I call it virgin urine, get it in the ED before they've received massive doses of diuretics. Oftentimes, if they are taking their home diuretics, it may reflect their home diuretics, but, essentially, I like to look to see if their kid, like I said before, are the nephrons alive or dead? So if the nephrons are concentrating, the urine osms are really high, if the urine sodium is really low, so they're salt avid, I know the nephrons are alive, and they're volume overloaded. They're massively congested on exam, and you do a bedside echo, and their LV is 10%, and they've got a big congested right atrium and IVC. Then I'm more confident that the Lasix or the diuretic that I choose it will take effect, because they should. If the nephrons are alive, they should. Ideally, you should respond to the Lasix. If you get into a situation where there's an ATN-like picture, I really try and get my house staff to get casts. Get the UA, spin it for casts. If you see dead sloughing nephrons, then I'm less enthusiastic about the physiology of Lasix working in those patients. So you've got to first figure out why they're in ATN, and then second, you got to come up with maybe a plan B where you focus maybe more on venodilation, and if the the renal function is really bad, then you might want to get your nephrologists on board. I once had an intensivist when I was a resident who said that he could, in patients like that, he could make a rock urinate by giving them a bottle of albumin with 200 of Lasix and I believe a gram of calcium. He said he can make anything pee on that regimen. So that's not something I would pull off without a nephrologist on board. So yeah, that's kind of how I approach my use of diuretics. Another thing that I've sort of invoked really in the last 6 months, I was in the cirrhosis realm. I thought this was kind of a neat study where the it was mentioned in a review by Runyon, I guess the guru of ascites, R-U-N-Y-O-N, I believe. Mm-hmm. I forget his first name. Talking about the natriuretic effect of diuretics. And so what was recommended in this review was you can get something called a spot urine sodium to potassium ratio.
Okay.
And in this study, it was from 2009, I forget the journal, it was like World Journal of Gastroenterology or something that I'd never heard of. But if they correlated a spot, just a now urine sodium potassium ratio, if the ratio was like 1.5 to 2, so your urine sodium is 30, your urine potassium is 15, it's highly correlated with a 24-hour urine excretion of 2 grams of sodium, or 88 millimoles if you're for Canadians. And so that tells you that the kidneys are responding appropriately to diuretics. You're getting a quote-unquote natriuretic effect.
Okay.
And so in particular in cirrhotic patients, if the cirrhotic patient comes in and they're gaining ascites, they're gaining fluid weight, they're getting edema, and you get a urine sodium potassium ratio and it's 2, well, they're peeing out at least 2 grams of sodium or 88 millimoles. So from that, you can infer that they're essentially not sticking to their diet.
Because
if they're peeing out 88 millimoles of sodium every 24 hours, again, this is a correlation, and they're still gaining salt and water, then you can infer that they're eating more than 2 grams of sodium. If they're not getting a natriuretic effect on the dose of diuretics, if the urine sodium potassium ratio is like 1 or 0.5 or something, then the diuretics are being dosed are not having an effect. And so that's the point when I start going up on the Lasix and the spironolactone. In the heart failure patient, to my knowledge, hasn't been studied, but I extrapolate the data from cirrhotics to heart failure patients. And this is something I've done just recently in the last 6 months where I look to see if I'm getting a quote-unquote natriuretic effect on the Lasix regimen that I'm using. So I'll tell my house officers, you know, in the morning, let's get just a spot, U sodium, U potassium, calculate the ratio. If it's low and they're not losing weight, it's our problem because we're not getting a natriuretic effect. If it's high and they're not losing weight, then somebody's coming in with some Chipotle or something or some cans of soup and they're cheating.
Oh, very interesting stuff. So when do you automatically add on your spironolactone, or do you... In heart failure, yeah.
Because
that's been a trend in the last, you know, bunch of years.
Great question. I try to. What I found is that cardiologists seem to be reluctant, which doesn't make sense. I mean, so the reasoning that I get from... So the Rowles trial came out in the late 90s for spironolactone in, you know, depressed EF heart failure. And chronically, there was a mortality benefit, which you don't see in internal medicine. So my mind is always, aldactone, spironolactone should be on all heart failure patients with NYHA 3-4 depressed EF. So I try and add it on all patients as an inpatient. But in speaking with cardiologists about that trial, there's less enthusiasm with Rowles, because if you actually look at Rowles, only 10 to 20% of the patients in RALS were on beta blockers.
Oh.
Chronically.
Right.
And so I think some cardiologists think that some of the efficacy of spironolactone may have been washed away if all of the patients in that trial were on beta blockers. So why were the patients not on beta blockers in that trial with a low EF? Well, the trial came out in 99, mm-hmm. and so they were enrolling through the mid-90s.
And it wasn't yet the,
yes.
so the era of...
Carvedilol came out in the mid-90s, and even at that point in time, there were still people that thought if you added beta blockers to patients with heart failure, you're committing malpractice. So there just wasn't the adoption at that point. So it tends to be one of those meds that I find that cardiologists kind of add last, like ACE inhibitor, carvedilol, or long-acting metoprolol, and then spironolactone. But if I have the chance to, I always try to.
Okay.
What about you?
Well, I don't deal with sort of the chronic CHFers too much. I mostly really just do ICU. And I know that some people use it a fair bit. I don't have that reflex to put it on everyone. But I was wondering what your approach was on that.
Yeah, like if I'm diuresing a heart failure patient, they got a low EF, and I'm diuresing them, and I'm actually running into low potassium.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense.
Flip on some aldactone, potentially mortality benefit, potentially save me some repletion headache. But yeah, that's my approach.
Okay. Any other tidbits on these volume overloaded patients you can think of?
I'm curious about your opinion on morphine in heart failure exacerbation.
I think acutely and as a venodilator, especially in the sort of the flash pulmonary edema categories, morphine, IV nitro. I mean, I think those things work really fast, especially if you've got someone who's sort of a borderline needing intubation or borderline needing non-invasive, someone who you think you might be able to tip over while the Lasix kicks in, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And especially if they truly are volume overloaded. Because actually, one of the issues that I found is that you get a lot of these diagnoses of flash pulmonary edema, which I would say is not a diagnosis. Right? They're not necessarily volume overloaded.
Yeah.
They may be ischemic only, and then you have to just address the actual issue. But I don't know if you see that a lot, but we see a lot of these, what I like to call, it's still a lack of a diagnosis. Because to me, a flash pulmonary edema is not a diagnosis, it's a clinical syndrome.
Yeah.
And you got to hunt down the cause for it.
Exactly, Well, there's a lot of topics there. I would say that the most common clinical scenario where I see the quote-unquote flash is probably hypertensive emergency.
Yeah.
And even then, the teaching is that these patients can actually be paradoxically volume deplete.
Mm-hmm.
And they could just be simply redistributing volume into their chest. And that if you're truly having a hypertensive emergency, you can actually get this pressure naturesis where you're perfusing the glomeruli at a high perfusion pressure and you could actually be losing sodium. And so sometimes in these quote-unquote flash patients that are hypertensive emergencies, they get diuretics, and then the blood pressure issues go away, and then suddenly they tank. They go they go off the other end. I've definitely used morphine in patients that have pulmonary edema, whether it's flash or ischemia or otherwise. But I know that morphine has had some bad press, I think. I don't know the literature off the top of my head, but there's some people that think that it could worsen outcomes with CHF. And I haven't dug into the literature, and I don't think it's robust literature, but I've continued to use it under the principle as a venodilator. And then also, physiologically, it really mitigates work of breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, just anecdotally, even giving patients, honestly, a little bit of benzos or morphine, if it drops that work of breathing, in theory, if you're lowering the negative swings in intrathoracic pressure you're getting, you're actually reducing the afterload. Because if you're sucking in a negative...
Doing a mini Mueller maneuver at every breath.
You're increasing the wall stress against the LV, and it's making it harder for the LV to eject blood to the systemic circulation. So, physiologically, morphine is a nice adjunct, but I think that there are some people, and again, I'm ignorant of the literature, who are less enthusiastic, but I've continued to use it as well as other venodilators as well. And then obviously, non-invasive... ventilation, I think, is a nice adjunct as well. And I'm curious, have you used a lot of high flow, or and or have you used high flow in acute heart failure exacerbations?
Yeah, I use a fair bit of it. I kind of see it as the intermediate step before the BiPAP, okay. CPAP type of thing, and I think obviously it's much better tolerated.
Yes.
You know, especially in the somewhat agitated patients, or you know, someone you don't necessarily. They're not going to tolerate the pressure of the mask and all that. I think it works well. I think it's a half step, and I think a lot of times you can get away with it, especially if you've got, you know, stuff going in, mm-hmm. nitrates, morphine, diuretic, that'll hopefully turn the tide in the next little bit. So, yeah, we've had it for a few years now, and I find it pretty useful.
Cool.
Okay, I think that's pretty good for CHF.
Yeah. Did you learn the LMNOP mnemonic when you were in the house? Lasix, morphine, nitrates, oxygen. That's what I teach. Positive pressure.
LMNOP, remember that. All right, thanks, John.